Hello and welcome to this, our latest Deep Awake Dialogue. My name is Richard Cox and I'm here with Tim Freak. And today we're going to be starting what might be a number of little talks on how Tim's philosophy has progressed and changed and where it stayed the same from his early books to now with the writing of Soul Story, and addressing some of the questions that are coming up on Tim's forum, the Facebook forum. So for this first video, we're going to discuss materialism and idealism, or physicalism and mentalism, this core philosophical idea that's run on throughout history, how, Tim, you viewed that in your early writings, and how it's progressed on since then. So good afternoon, Tim.
Hi. A nice light topic for today.
Yeah, well, it's materialism, idealism, these are kind of strange words. So I think we're titling the video, Is Life a Dream? Which brings it into more something people will be interested to know about or not. Is life a dream? So let's start off with that, Tim. If you would give us something of a definition of these terms, maybe with materialism is perhaps the one that it's easiest for people to relate to and understand.
Although really what's happened, I mean, I think, we need to expand it out anyway, because materialism is a kind of 19th century idea that's when it really took off. I mean, it's always been there, right back to the Greeks, but it's the idea that what's really real is this. Now, the problem for materialism is that in terms of physics, which is the investigation of this, this isn't there in the way we think it is. So that the materialism itself, I think, is really a dead philosophy, but it's replaced by a kind of physicalism, as you said, or objectivism is what I call it, which is still saying, look, the object, the thing, is what's real. And that's usually contrasted with the fact that you're a conscious being, mm-hmm. and that you're experiencing all of these things. And the idea there is that the conscious being has arisen from the physical object, mm-hmm. and is kind of secondary to it. And so what really is real is the physical object, and this is secondary. And then the other view is the polar opposite of that.
Yeah.
So that it's called, I mean, idealism is a really bad name for most people, because that sounds like people who have high ideals.
Yeah,
in this context, it doesn't mean that. It's a view which you call it mentalism, which is a good name for it. It's a form of a philosophy which is found in most versions of spirituality, especially ancient spirituality. And that does the opposite. That goes, this is all existing in the subject, in consciousness. And that's why the metaphor of it's like a dream. Like a dream exists in consciousness. All of these so-called objects are actually forms that are arising in consciousness.
Okay, so just see if I sum that up and see if I get it right there. Materialism, in that philosophy, consciousness is almost like an accidental byproduct of the material that we can see came into existence 13 billion years ago. What it was doing before that, we don't know. But as a byproduct of that, it's given rise to consciousness, which some materialists see even as being kind of an illusion, right? It doesn't really exist. It's just we've tricked ourselves into thinking that the universe has become conscious of itself. All you really have is atoms interacting. And then idealism places the conscious mind at the center of things. So like when we experience a dream, I can say, well, this glass of water, it looks like it's outside of my mind, but if I knew I was dreaming right now, I'd say, oh, actually, I know it's inside my mind. It's a mental projection. There are really no atoms. There are no atoms in dreams. It's all consciousness. Is that
Yes, it's all forms, like in a dream. The atoms can be forms. Now, obviously, there's different ways of understanding both of those. Some materialists would have a higher view of consciousness than you're giving it there, or objectivists. Mm. And, of course, there's problems with seeing it like a dream, because it's like, well, is it my dream, or is it your dream, or is it both of our dreams, or is there something greater than us which is dreaming this? So there's lots of different ways of perceiving it. But those are the two oppositions. For me, the way that I frame it in the mystery experience is going, look, it's fundamentally a debate about whether we're putting the object as the ground of being. It's really an object and it gives rise to subjects, or it's really subjective in nature and it's giving rise to objects as forms which we experience.
Okay, just to ask you a biographical question, Tim. I think in the spiritual traditions, you could say it's often seen that the materialism is the illusion that the human being comes into the soul, comes into the body, and the forms around us, the material world, is so compelling and it's bright colors and loud sounds that we believe it's real and we believe it has an existence outside of our minds. We get drawn into this illusion. And the spiritual process is to track back into consciousness and see that it's arising within mind, that these things aren't really external to us. So this is more of a dreamlike reality. And do you recall a process like that happening in yourself after your initial mystical experiences, interest in this? I'm assuming that you might have in your young life been a materialist, because that's the common view, whether you thought about it or not. Was there a point where you started to actively investigate?
I don't think there ever was, Richard, because it never made sense to me, because my experience of life was always magical. Now, I don't think I went straight to an idealist or mentalist philosophy. I don't think I was sophisticated enough to do that. So I didn't really question. I wasn't able at that point to question or answer these things. That came later when I was older. So at the time, I would say there was just a sense that I was in a magical process, and the idea of materialism, especially that reductionism that goes with it, which reduces this to just this. Anything which does that was, I can remember feeling that I dismissed science as a young person completely, because it was telling me about, you know, how iron filings work, but it was telling me nothing about the meaning of life, because it reduced everything to this very basic kind of cause and effect world. But the world I was in wasn't like that. It was a magical world. And so what I was looking for was something which could address that. And that's why I ended up studying spirituality and then understanding these other philosophies. So I think it was just like I didn't come from there to there.
Right. Okay.
I kind of was in this magic world and then looking for a way to explain it. And materialism was a non-starter, because it didn't remotely explain it.
Okay, yeah, I was very interested in physics when I was a teenager, and very, like,
right,
really materialist, and thought the material is the ground of being. And
right.
I suppose I kept going into that and found it increasingly empty on a personal level. So, like, on the one hand, the physics and the nature of atoms was fascinating, and it was like a god to me, I suppose, like studying the ultimate reality. But my personal life took on, like, less and less meaning, because, well, we're just a pile of these atoms, and however amazing they are, it doesn't make for a life just to be a pile of atoms. So
yeah,
that's what almost projected me right into the spiritual then, of like this, when I saw the feasibility of the spiritual, that it wasn't just hocus pocus and nonsense, that, oh, okay, this is an escape from the cave.
Fascinating. Yeah, I think a lot of people go that route. I think because the experiences I was having as a young person, that was just kind of blown out of the water very young. In some ways, kind of too young, because I've had to come back to all of that and study that in later life to go, actually, that's really interesting, isn't it? And as you know, a lot of my time now is spent around science. But for a long time, that was all just completely dismissed for me, because it couldn't address the actual experience that I was having.
Yeah.
Because,
and of course, you were very invested in the study of magic and manifestation.
I did try to be a materialist a bit when I got into studying Karl Marx at university. I was quite attracted to that. But I was always a heretical studier of Karl Marx, because, you know, he'd said that, well, he's an interesting person, because he took an idealism which Hegel had developed and claimed to turn it on its head and create a dialectical materialism.
Yeah.
And so for me, as a paralogical thinker, a lot of my paralogical thinking comes from the dialectics of Hegel and then Marx. It's been very influenced by that, the bringing together of opposites. But I kind of wanted to turn it back again and go, actually, I think Hegel might have got it right. And
well, this is something I wasn't sure if we'd talk about or not, but as you've touched on it, there is this link between Marxism, communism, and materialism. And I think a lot of people ponder, are there inevitable outcomes to embracing certain philosophical positions? Like, does materialism lead to a negative view of the world? Does it lead to consumerism? That's a connection people often make.
Does it lead to
communism? Yeah. Does idealism lead to a certain political position or certain attitudes or mindsets to life?
I think that can happen. And I would say, you know, you got something like with Marx, who's got this beautiful sentiment of creating a world where everything, you know, from each according to their ability, each to each according to their need. I mean, that's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. And the aspirations behind early communism are beautiful. But when it's rooted in what were just the philosophy of the day, really, I mean, the cutting edge of the time was materialism. That was the new thing. And it was very exciting, and it was science. And so by rooting in that, I think it created a world which was utilitarian in the most horrible way, and didn't value consciousness, individuals, was able to rove roughshod over different ideas and actually do the very opposite of what it set it out to do. And I suspect a lot of that, and obviously the conditions of the day were important, and Marx would be the first to say that, but also I feel you're right. I think it's the actual philosophy underpinning it which makes you view. Having said that, you know, an awful lot of the spiritual idealist mentalist view is also very negative. It does this. I mean, the reason I've tried to go beyond both is because materialism reduces it all to the object, but a lot of spirituality reduces it all to the subject, and again makes the experience something you're trapped in, a mistake, something that's wrong. It feels like what we need is an alternative.
Yeah, I think I tend to see things more that way. That if you're going to be negative and have a dour view of life, you can make any philosophy fit that, whether it's materialism or spiritualism or anything. So I'm always a little, I can see how people take a materialist.
You could certainly make a good argument. I mean, people have, I'm not saying it's true, but you could, you know, make a good argument that one of the things which has held back countries like India from giving their inhabitants a much higher quality of life, as we've been able to enjoy here, has been that they haven't made that, you know, hadn't until recently made that transition. They've been so much in a worldview where this is a mistake, where you've fallen into something, where it's about getting away from this and not being trapped here and having to go round and round in this endless cycle of suffering, which is a very negative view of human life. And it comes that one comes from a mentalist perspective. So, you know, it's a paralogical thing to say, I know, but there's both, isn't there? There's negative and positives in both.
So idealism then is where your work was about, well, when you started and were writing the Jesus Mysteries books and all the books around that time. Would you say that's accurate to say it falls into the mentalist idealism?
Yeah, I mean, maybe what I'll do is just go through the process. And it's very interesting for me to try and capture it. I've not done that at all, apart from to myself in the shower, thinking it through. I haven't actually had a conversation, I don't think, with anyone. So it's a great opportunity with you to try and to really articulate what that journey's been. And I'd say that when I started writing lots and lots of books on different spiritual traditions, I was looking for a commonality. And what became obvious was, this idealism or this spiritual perspective of it's all a dream is one way of seeing what that commonality is. So that when I reached to write the Jesus and the Goddess and the Jesus Mysteries and write about Gnosticism, I was beginning to see Christianity in a whole new light that had this perennial philosophy in it. The perennial philosophy that this is a, well, the view which I articulated there was already a kind of evolutionist view. It was going, look, this is a, what I think they're saying is this is God exploring himself or itself. Mm-hmm. This is a one big mind, so that this is not my dream or your dream, it's God's dream. And of course, that's a very clearly articulated in the Indian philosophy with this is the dream of Brahman. But also you see it in all of these Gnostic mystical philosophies. So there's one being dreaming the dream of life, and we are that being dreaming itself to be Tim and Richard and lost in this illusion. That's a very common view of it. You can have more positive views, which I tried to articulate, a more positive gnosis in Jesus and the Lost Goddess, because some of the Gnostics have it, whereby it's a kind of process of discovery. So it's not just being lost, it's actually an evolutionary process of discovery. But fundamentally, that was the vision. And what I was looking for there was, the first thing was, oh my God, Christianity's about this too. That was huge. And so I had this overarching kind of background philosophy, and I was looking for how can I get this across in an experiential way? Because for me, it's not just a philosophy in I believe this, it's an experience. I experience this background being to my nature very powerfully, which I'm one with everything, as well as being Tim. And I was looking for how can I articulate that for myself and for others? And that's when I wrote Lucid Living and The Laughing Jesus, which went, this is the analogy I can use is simply of lucid dreaming. Mm. Mm-hmm. That waking up from being lost in something and not knowing that you're the dreamer to waking up and going, oh, you're the dreamer, but not Tim, Tim being dreamt. This idea, this, that there's a deeper level to my being, which is universal. So I'm God dreaming himself to be Tim, meeting God dreaming himself to be Richard. And these are really beautiful and powerful and ancient ideas, which I feel I was astonished at. I thought how clearly I could communicate them to people through the work I did with Lucid Living. And I want to say, but probably and is better. I also, as my own journey took me from waking up to this oneness back into life more and more and more into the separateness, because it was no longer one or the other. It's definitely was both and for me. I was finding difficulty expressing what the human journey was about from that perspective. And that's where you see this current coming into my work in How Long Is Now, for instance, of this is an evolutionary journey we're in. It was already there in Jesus and the Goddess 20 years ago. But it was like I was wanting to explore this idea that this wasn't negative. This wasn't a mistake. That this was a process in which this one being was exploring itself, mm-hmm. was coming to know itself. And in doing that, I was beginning to find that this calling this background consciousness is problematic. And partly it's words. In a way, it's partly philosophical, it's partly linguistic. When I wrote it about it, first of all, in Jesus and the Goddess, I went down the traditional route that others had gone down, and I called the background, the big mind, consciousness with a capital C. Mm-hmm. So it's like consciousness, and people do that. And then I was stuck with this inelegant stuff in Jesus and the Goddess where I wanted to say, but where it arises from is unconscious. So it's unconscious consciousness. And that was a bit difficult. So in later books, I switched what I talked about the background as awareness. So you can have awareness, which was unconscious or conscious, mm-hmm. all attempting to do this. And then increasingly, it felt to me like the word consciousness is not a good word, because I want to say that the universe has become conscious. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that before the evolution, certainly of life, probably the evolution of advanced forms of life, that what was there wasn't conscious in the way that we use the word.
Can I just?
That's when I needed to start looking in different directions.
Can I hold you for a clarification there?
Yeah.
I think when you talk about consciousness coming from unconsciousness, I think you've written about this in a way that's everybody's experience in terms of the sleep state.
Yeah.
How consciousness and psyche emerge out of the unconscious. Let's see if I can say this right now. So when I wake up in the morning, I come from this unconscious consciousness, and then consciousness and the mind, the witness and the thing it's witnessing, arise as a pair. Is that?
Yeah. Yes. So if I jump forward now to where I am now, I'm beginning to feel like, because I think there's a whole lot of problems with actually, but I think that just about works, unconscious consciousness, this subject. But for me, it's starting to work better if I say, look, there's unconscious being becomes conscious being. You know, there's what I am, whatever that is, which is now unconscious, and now it becomes conscious. And that is happening every day with me falling asleep and waking up. And then it's happening in the whole journey. And what that allows me to do, and the other word I use is spirit, which means being, just because it's a traditional world, and it allows me to connect with Hegel and other things that philosophers have said. But being... spirit is the word I used in Soul Story and in various other places, and goes right in, because I'm echoing the Gnostics, really, mm-hmm. going back to that. But really, I'm becoming round to the idea that one of the better words might be being, because these words, you know, they've all got problems because they all mean different things to different people. But the fundamental idea which you can get then is that there is spirit or being which is exploring itself. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a different idea now to the idea of consciousness doing it, because then it becomes conscious in that process.
Right.
The big problem with, well, maybe I should just stop for a second and just quickly do what happened in the mystery experience, because that's significant, is that there where I articulated this idea of paralogical thinking, seeing things from other perspectives, is where I said, look, you can look at this same process of evolution objectively and you see an objects evolving, or subjectively and you see it all arising with mind. And the idea I was playing with there is you can see it in both ways. And I still think that's true. I haven't, you know, that's right. In fact, generally, what I'm doing is I'm trying to articulate the same thing that I've been seeing clearer and clearer in better and better language. I don't think there's been any great shift away from anything.
Right, so you don't consider your work in Soul Story to be a break with the Gnostics as you were presenting them in...
It's an evolution from. So there's there is profound differences. Big difference from many of the Gnostics. I see this as an evolutionary process, which is positive. Big difference for sure. I now know, you know, along with knowing the world isn't flat, I also know that there's been 13.8 billion years of evolution leading to this, one way or another. And so I'm taking that on board. And I know that human beings weren't just created, I know they've evolved. And so we can see the universe becoming conscious. Now, the question then is, what's the ground of that? And the traditional scientific view is, oh, the Big Bang happens, there's just matter and energy, objects, and then they become subjects, whatever, somehow as a byproduct. The traditional spiritual view is, but the ground of being really is God or a big mind. Now, get rid of the creator God. I think we can dismiss that from this conversation. But we could keep Brahman. And that's what I tried to do and tried to gesture towards in Soul Story. In The Mystery Experience. But there are problems with that, because what you've done is you've stuck this super being in at the beginning. And if it's already there, why is it discovering itself? And you're stuck with all of the problems I articulate in the book about any great being. You know, this being is really God, is compassionate, is good. Why all the suffering? Why the horrors of life? Why the dinosaurs? All of those questions. So what I've done is I've gone, look, I did this actually in The Mystery Experience. So the Soul Story is an evolution from that. Is going, instead of looking at it as either objective or subjective, idealism or materialism, let's follow David Bohm, the great physicist, and see that there's something before both, which is neither objective nor subjective. That's the real non-dual. The real non-dual isn't consciousness, like most non-dual teachers say. That's still dual, because there's consciousness and what it's conscious of.
Yeah.
But to go to something which is before both, call it spirit, call it being. If you want a description of it, which is more important than a name, then the best description, I think, is potentiality. That it's the potentiality for the universe. It's the potentiality from which everything is coming, including this moment right now. That there's a potentiality of being which is realizing itself.
This, you wrote about this in Jesus and the Goddess, did you not? With the concept of the Trinity, of consciousness and psyche arising out of something deeper than both of them.
Exactly.
So this is consistent.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah. So what what I called mystery there would be that version that the Gnostics had with mystery and then consciousness or pneuma, spirit, and psyche or soul. So God, spirit, and soul, as it were. That Trinity for me is now expanded out, because here we are in the 21st century with modern science, and it's gone, there is a ground of being, let's call it spirit again, or we can call it being, whatever you like, but it's potentiality, it's mystery, it's nothing, and yet it's the potentiality for everything. So it's not nothing in the negative sense, it's because it's the pleroma, in a way, of the ancient Gnostics. It's full with the potentiality for everything. And it's realizing itself. And as it does that, all of these dualities appear. And right from the very start is the duality of subject and object. Not one or the other, but both, right from the start. And the way that I've articulated that is going, look, right from the beginning, you have a time stream, you have a flow of time, because it's very important for me that I've put this whole thing in motion, which is information, objectively. So you've got primitive atoms, for example. But each primitive atom is also reading its environment. The mere fact that it's relatively individual or distinct means it has a relationship with the whole. And that relationship with the whole is it's discriminating what's going on around it. The charges of other atoms, its relationship with other, eventually other chemicals, and it just all of that stuff that it's reading. in very primitive ways, but it is. It's interacting. It's discriminating. That's the sub. That's proto-subjectivity. So you've got proto-objectivity, atoms, which actually don't exist in the way we think they do. They're not things, but they become things when gathered together enough. Or they become things for us when we experience them like that. So you've got this dual evolution at the same time of object, ever more complex objectivity, which is information, and ever more complex subjectivity, which starts as proto-conscious electrochemical discrimination that will evolve into primitive sensual discrimination and then into the full senses we've got, and then finally into conceptual discrimination in when we reach soul. And the information is evolving alongside it. So we've done away with this. Is it an object or is it a subject? Is it idealism or is it materialism? And we have a paralogical philosophy which goes, no, it's something before both, giving rise to all of these dualities which always exist together. So there is no objective world which is not being observed, because it's always being observed by itself. And there is no observer without the objective world, mm-hmm. because that's what gives rise to the subject, is that there's an object, and that they're both arising and evolving together as the potentiality, what I called spirit or being or history, is unfolding and realizing itself.
And this is, I'm just trying to get my head around, do you see this as distinct from a statement like saying, yes, life is then a dream?
Okay, that's great. Good to come back with that, because that's the key. That's the key thing that I need to be able to convey to people, is that people who've got, who've been with me on a journey and have gone, oh, I get it, it's like a dream. Am I still saying that or am I not? Mm-hmm. I am still saying that, but in a different way. Or rather, I have, this is a bigger picture which includes that. So for me, at this level, I'm here now as a human being, and I'm experiencing the ground of being, the potentiality, spirit. I can reflect back and I can see that that spirit is the just as spirit or being is manifesting as everything. Let's just bring in Plato, because although I've refashioned him considerably, there's a nice little thing which he plays with being and becoming, and I'm doing the same. I'm saying that there's being, which is in a process of evolutionary becoming through emergence. And that goes back to the goddess as well. We use those terms there. So I have become a human being who's conscious, and I can be conscious of my being. And when that happens, I'm conscious of this formless, timeless presence, which is witnessing this. So I'm conscious that the witness of everything on the deepest level is being. Is this deep spirit. That's spiritual awakening. And you go, oh my God, I'm one with all being, because there's one being witnessing everything. But the one being is witnessing this particular flow of Tim, like it's also witnessing that particular flow of Richard. So we're back at exactly the same perennial philosophy, but in a different way, where it's going, well, and then for me, it's not then like there is one dream of life. It's more like everything is dreaming, because everything, every subjective experience is the objective information being interpreted in a certain way. So I live in this world where, you know, there's my coffee cup and it feels like a thing, but I know from physics that actually there is no three-dimensional solid object there. So my experience is not the world. That's my experience of what's really out there. What's really out there is information, which I'm experiencing as this, because this is the level of emergence that I've arrived at. And that's why all of this that I'm experiencing is arising within my awareness, like a dream is.
Okay, but you said information is out there. Okay.
Yes.
So is information out there when you dream at night and experience the coffee cup?
No, and that's key. And that's why, you know, right from the start, I've always said, this is like a dream. There is a difference, and it's important to know. I mean, I've been with other teachers who've gone, it's a dream, and I've gone, and I can't tell the difference between this and a dream. And my always feeling is, well, you should be able to, because there's a difference, and we don't want to lose that
difference. Okay, but could it not be a different kind of, like, I get this, you can tell the difference. And when we spoke to Charlie Morley, he said that the lucid dreaming teacher, he said it's very important in learning lucid dreaming that you can tell the difference.
Exactly.
But
So what,
there are different types of dreams, though, right? I mean, here's
the difference between, or I'm talking about the common. Well, I want to push it both ways. I want to say, look, actually, you can go into a deep dream state where you still meet objective information.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say here, what marks this out from the narrower subjective? Well, what marks this out from my imagining now is that if I imagine the cup, it has no reality distinct from my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But this cup, even though my perception of it is existing through my own way of perceiving it, it exists independently. And if you were here, I could give it to you and you could have the cup. So there is information out there. It's not that there's an objective world independent, because it's always experiencing itself. So it's not like a dream in that way in which we think of it. But I've never thought that, because it's always been God's dream. It's never been Tim's dream.
Sure. So it's not my curiosity to ask you, and I don't think it's other people's of, is this Tim's dream, solipsistic view?
Yeah. Yeah.
But just to challenge you on that, couldn't we have that experience in a dream? So if you dream of this conversation tonight, you can have a cup in your hand, and you can also dream that you're imagining a cup.
Yeah.
So on one level, you've got the imaginary cup, the real cup, and you can pass the real cup to me, but not the imaginary cup. But on another level, on the level of the dreamer, both of those cups are imaginary. They're all arising. So is that distinct from...
It depends what you're asking me. If you're asking me, can I know this is not a dream?
Yeah.
Then okay. I think the answer is probably not. Because all I ever have is my experience. And people who are idealists usually fall back on that. The argument with, and my method is to look at the moment, fundamentally. And when you look at the moment, you see what? Well, really, if you pay attention, what you see is appearances arising within consciousness. That's what you see. So the next step for a lot of spiritual people is, that's what's real. Appearances arising in consciousness. Take a look. It's indisputable. No consciousness, no appearances. That's the way it's arising. For me, I want to go further than that, because that's just the first step. The next step goes, and what are these appearances? Do they exist independently from me or not? And my answer is yes and no. The way I'm perceiving them does not exist independently from me, but they also exist independently from me and can be perceived by you, by a snail, by a bat, in very different ways. And they're not completely dependent on my particular consciousness. The other big thing I want to be able to say is that this is to avoid solipsism, is that what's so interesting is that I see the moment, all of these forms arising in consciousness, but you're here. And I do not see you as just a form arising within my consciousness. I see you as an independent conscious being. And once I do that, then the whole thing explodes. And I'm into a completely different way of seeing what reality is, way beyond its just appearances. There's something much more interesting and paralogical going on than that. And that's why naive idealism, which you see a lot in the non-dual world, really doesn't work for me, because it's not going far enough. It's just step one. That's all, the first observation.
So by the naive idealism, your earlier work, do you feel that was outside of naive idealism, in that the coffee cup exists independently of your perception, but it could exist for both of us, either because it has an independent material existence or because it has an existence in the one mind in both, which Richard and Tim and the coffee cup were arising?
That's the way that I went with it. And I think to avoid that, I just went, look, it's not my dream. It's not your dream. That's solipsism. Solipsism, for those that don't know the term, I realize we've been using it. That's the idea that all exists. All that exists is what I perceive, because that's actually what I experience. So that's all I know. That's all that exists.
And it's all Tim's dream.
It's all me. That's it. Nothing else is real. And
as you do experience in a dream, like, dreams seem to us to be like solipsism. So we genuinely we have dreams sometimes where we feel there was something more going on than our direct consciousness, but mostly we interpret it as our own mind that's being projected around us.
Certainly when we wake up, yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. That's the kind of naive view that I wanted to avoid. My way, as you say, was to say, look, take the dream of Brahman. This is not Tim's dream. It's not your dream. This is God's dream, and God is dreaming himself to be Tim and experiencing this. And in a way, I'm still saying exactly that. I'm saying that there is a primal being which is realizing itself. You can say dreaming if you like, but realizing itself as everything. The reason that I didn't use the word dreaming, I thought about it, but I avoided it in Soul Story. I mentioned it a bit, is because that works fine for us, but not so well for snails and not so well for atoms. And so what I want to say is every particular time stream, the being, God, is subjectively experiencing itself through everything. So it's dreaming itself to be an atom and experiencing reality through being an atom. It's dreaming itself to be a snail or realizing itself as a snail and so forth. Now, the dreaming analogy works fine if you stick consciousness at the beginning. But if you want to avoid that for the reasons we've been discussing, suddenly the analogy is not so good to understand the whole 13.8 billion years of evolution. It's brilliant to help people awaken. I still use it as it's just fantastic for us at our level to get that. For me, for an atom is not reflecting on anything. It's not conscious, or it's not, it doesn't know that it's really the oneness of all being. It's just being an atom or a snail or whatever. So it doesn't know this depth. We can know this depth. And when we do, then it's like, oh, I see the thing which is my depth within which all these appearances are arising is the oneness of being. And that's when the analogy works. So I've been trying to steer away from that because I feel that we need to go beyond these ancient teachings now. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing, it seems to me, is that the future of spirituality lies in an evolutionary or emergent spirituality. That's the one that feels like it can unite itself with science, it can be intellectually robust, and it can really take forward the essence of what spirituality is. So somehow we need to do that. And Soul Story is just the beginning. But really, Mystery Experience was. And now Soul Story is trying to go, right, let's get this. What's the language which can help us get this?
Okay, there's a lot there. Okay. So I feel like today what we might do is leave it there for today. And unless there's anything you want to say further, but we can post this video up and put it on Facebook. And if people comment in the Tim Freak forum, I'll put a link to beneath the video or whatever platform you're getting this on. And you can join the forum for these kind of discussions on these issues. And if people have any observations or comments or questions, if you post them in the comments there, we can have a bit of a discussion there. And also maybe we can, for whatever comes out of that, do another video reflecting on those points in the future.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. It might be a very great way of taking this conversation forward. It's been a real interesting challenge to try and articulate the movement and why I think it's so essential. And I'm sure there's much further to go, but it's been a very enjoyable start.
Yeah. And if people help me out and post some stuff, I might be able to come back with some more precise questions and see if we can nail this down even further. So thanks very much, Tim. It was a very enjoyable conversation.
Thank you. I loved it, Richard. It was great.
Great. Okay. See you soon.